Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. Today, I'll have readings from the New York Times, the Dayton, Ohio Daily News, the Washington Post, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and I'm going to start with this article from Time Magazine. The title is How the U.S. Used African American Artists as Cold War Ambassadors. It was written by Tamara Walker and published February 20, 2024. In February 1958, 26-year-old African-American pianist Philippa Schuyler paid a visit to Morocco. Afterward, her mother received an enthusiastic letter from the United States Foreign Service. Philippa came, saw, and conquered Rabat and Casablanca. She was interviewed over the radio and gave concerts to two enthusiastic audiences. We were all very proud and happy over her performances here. The Morocco stops marked the culmination of a 14-country tour of Africa that began the previous month in Nigeria. Along the way, Schuyler met Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, Ghana's Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah, President William Tubman of Liberia, as well as a host of royals, cabinet members, dignitaries, and university students from across the continent. Black newspapers in the United States hailed it as the most extensive tour ever made by an American performer in Africa. Together, these accounts, one sent to her doting mother and carefully placed within the pages of a scrapbook, the other sent across the wires to be printed for an African-American reading public, tell a story that holds especially important meaning during this year's Black History Month honoring African-Americans and the arts. The theme was chosen by the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, which was founded by prolific historian Carter G. Woodson, to highlight how, in the fields of visual and performing arts, literature, fashion, folklore, language, film, music, architecture, culinary, and other forms of cultural expression, the African American influence has been paramount. Looking back to the winter of 1958 helps us understand that the reach of that influence extended far beyond the many artistic fields where African Americans have made their marks. Schuyler's tour came at a fraught moment in history. Back home in the United States, African Americans were facing the relentless drumbeat of racial exclusion, persecution, and terror. As the only child of George, a Black newspaper editor and author, and Josephine, a white iconoclast from a cattle ranching family in Texas that disowned her when she married, Schuyler had experienced her share of the country's racism firsthand. Indeed, despite her precious musical talent, which saw her mastering classics and writing original compositions from an early age, and which her parents proudly trumpeted in the press, Schuyler found few opportunities to grace national stages. Instead, she spent most of her career abroad. The United States' treatment of African Americans at home exposed it to the criticism on the world stage. During the Cold War, in everything from propagandistic films to offers of refuge to African Americans, the Soviet Union regularly seized upon U.S. racism as a means of promoting the communist cause over capitalism, as well as to advance a more nefarious agenda. According to the historian Peniel Joseph, Russian communist officials, apparatchiks, and newspapers saw in America's unfolding racial crisis an opportunity to shield the Soviet Union from criticism of its own human rights violations, creeping authoritarianism, and barely concealed imperial ambitions. The reality of U.S. racism thus threatened to delegitimize the country's efforts to win democratic allies abroad and put it on a moral disadvantage vis-à-vis the Soviet Union. When Schuyler set off on her tour, the African continent was emerging from the shadow of European colonial rule. During this period of celebration and possibility, African Americans often had a front row seat to independence festivities that received ample news coverage. The publisher of outlets like Ebony and Jet took great expense to report the progress of independence abroad and to counter the stereotypical images of Blacks in the diaspora with countless meaningful articles about Africa, the cradle of all mankind, and its rich cultural heritage. As this occurred, both the Soviet Union and the United States raced to win newly independent nations in Africa to their respective sides in the Cold War. Following a 1957 visit to Morocco, Ghana, Liberia, Uganda, Ethiopia, Sudan, Libya, and Tunisia, then Vice President Richard Nixon sent a report to President Dwight Eisenhower. Africa, he told his boss, is a priority target for the international communist movement. They are trying desperately to convince the peoples of Africa that they support it more strongly than we do their natural aspirations for independence, equality, and economic progress. In short, the U.S. needed to curry favor within Africa to gain an advantage over the Soviet Union in the region. To counter Soviet messaging about American racism, the U.S. government took bold action. In 1955, the country appointed jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie and Duke Ellington to perform around the world as cultural ambassadors. Nicknamed the Jazz Ambassadors, their responsibilities came with profound moral dilemmas over representing a country that failed to live up to its obligations to its own citizens. But the ambassadors also found in their high-profile roles an opportunity to showcase their humanity and artistic prowess, promote the fight for equality back home, and build connections abroad. The Moroccan leg of Schuyler's African tour was part of a similar effort to quell criticism of the country and curry global favor. Schuyler devotes a chapter of her travel memoir, Adventures in Black and White, to her visit to the continent, which was hosted by an array of patrons. In it, she details the sights, smells, cuisines, and idiosyncrasies of the villages, towns, and urban centers she stopped in to give concerts in everything from private residences to grand public halls, receiving warm receptions at every turn. Having gone on concert tours around the world by herself since her early teens, including to Africa several times, Schuyler had an independent spirit, a vast network of contacts, a well of knowledge and curiosity about religious traditions and social customs, a keen eye for detail and a flair for storytelling. In other words, she had her own reasons, resources, and rewards for going on the tour beyond anything related to her country's geopolitical standing. By the time she made it to Morocco, Schuyler was exhausted and sick. "My stomach felt the flame," she wrote, "and as if riddled by bullet holes." Nonetheless, she somehow summoned the energy to set out for concerts in Casablanca and Rabat. "The next afternoon, I gave another recital, and under the patronage of Ambassador Cavendish Cannon and Her Royal Highness Princess Leila Aicha, Morocco's leading feminist and eldest daughter of Sultan Mohammed Hair, younger sister Princess Lala Neza, a beautiful girl dressed in smart Western clothes attended the performance and was photographed with me afterwards." In hosting Schuyler, the U.S. ambassador was able to shine a bright spotlight on a talented black pianist as a symbol of national pride and racial progress. In showing up as her full, worldly, dazzling self, Schuyler also served as a dazzling model of modern womanhood to which Moroccan women could aspire. With that, Schuyler ended her African tour having accomplished a complex, no doubt exhausting feat. Her visit served at once as a showcase for her prodigious talents, a one-woman charm offensive, a reputational victory for the United States, and as a source of racial pride among African Americans, all while signaling the vibrant energy of a continent looking towards the future. That was the Time magazine article titled, "How the U.S. Used African American Artists as Cold War Ambassadors." It was written by Tamara Walker and published February 20th, 2024. My next story deals with the official 2024 theme of Black History Month, which is African Americans and the Arts. This is from the New York Times newspaper, and the article is titled, "This Time, the Met Aims to Get Harlem Right." It was written by Holland Cotter and published February 21st, 2024. Notoriously, in the winter of 1969, the Metropolitan Museum of Art opened its first exhibition devoted to African American culture, but with a show devoid of art. Called Harlem on My Mind, Cultural Capital of Black America, 1900 to 1968, it was a photo mural with text affair of a kind found in ethnology museums. As a student in town on a visit, I wandered into the galleries, and even with scant knowledge of black history, I knew something was off. I soon learned I wasn't alone. The show was being slammed by pushback, a cohort of black contemporary artists, some living and working in Harlem, calling themselves the Black Emergency Cultural Coalition, had been picketing the museum and directing their protests to other museums, lighting a fuse that would eventually detonate in the multicultural wave of the 1980s. With its demands for inclusion and its affirmation of cultural identity in art as in life as a force. This week, more than half a century on, the Met opens its second survey of black art, this one called The Harlem Renaissance and Transatlantic Modernism. And it's a whole other thing. It's all art. More than 160 paintings, sculptures, and photographs. The museum isn't framing the show as an institutional correction, though how can it be viewed otherwise? At the same time, it's more than just that. It's the start, or could be, in moving a still-neglected art history out of the wings and onto the main stage. That history from roughly 1918 through the 1930s has complications. The Harlem Renaissance wasn't a thing in the sense of being a structured movement, though it did have its architects, notably two aspiring black public intellectuals, W.E.B. Du Bois and Alan Locke. Nor was it confined to Harlem or even New York City. Many of the artists closely associated with it lived and worked elsewhere, Chicago, Philadelphia, Paris. Finally, it wasn't strictly or even chiefly a visual art phenomenon. It was initially defined in terms of new directions in black literature. Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston were emergent stars, and music, particularly jazz. What it was a kind of atmospheric condition, a transcontinental and transatlantic vibe, an ideal of racial pride embodied in the term New Negro, a concept given instant currency through essays written by Locke and published in the progressive political journal Survey Graphic, which devoted its March 1925 issue to the theme of Harlem, Mecca of the New Negro. Locke's ideal, shaped by the Great Migration and World War I, was a new cosmopolitan black aesthetic blending Western classicism, European modernist innovation, African art, and black folk culture dominates the show, organized by Denise Morel, a Met curator at large. And a painted portrait of Locke by the German-American artist Winold Reiss is the first thing we see before being plunged into the hubbub of Harlem itself. One of the guys Morel has assigned us is the supreme photographer of the neighborhood, James Van Der Zee. In one of his pictures, he takes us to tea at a beauty salon run out of her home by the hair care entrepreneur Madam C.J. Walker, sometimes credited as America's first female self-made millionaire. In the company of her genteel clientele, Du Bois, who had conservative taste in culture, would surely have felt at home. By contrast, he would probably not have relished time spent in Jacob Lawrence's watercolor Pool Parlor, a cubistic crazy quilt of ricocheting lines from 1942, or in Archibald J. Motley Jr.'s 1933 picture titled The Plotters, which has us sitting in a back room somewhere with a huddle of tough guys who seem to be exchanging secrets we're better off not hearing. Back out on the street, we encounter marching bands and funeral homes, and in Street Life Harlem, a painting by the great William Henry Johnson, a highlight of this show, and an amazement in any show he's in, of a spectacularly dapper Harlem couple stepping out for a stroll beneath a tangerine slice of a moon. In a large adjoining gallery devoted to portraiture, we see black individuals up close and rich in stylistic diversity. The self-taught painter Horace Pippin's delightful Limner-style likeness of his wife, Jenny Orr Featherstone Wade Giles, wearing the equivalent of 1970s aviator glasses, sits across the room from one. Done in virtuosic academic mode by the underknown Philadelphia artist Laura Wheeler Waring of a pensive young woman cradling a pomegranate, which in turn sits close to a portrait of another young woman in red, this one by the Harlemite Charles Henry Alston, with a face resembling an African mask. The exhibition includes a cluster of thematic micro shows, all ripe for future elaboration, though sketchy here. One picks up the African thread in Harlem Renaissance art, taking an abstract Afro-Deco copper mask by the San Francisco artist Sargent Claude Johnson as evidence. Others suggest, in their shorthand way, Euro-American exchanges of influence. The political painter-to-be Hale Woodruff creates modern impressionist landscapes. Henry Matisse, who hung out in Harlem on trips to New York, paints black models. More dynamic by far are the show's concentration on works by individual artists. A nook-like arrangement of four side-by-side figure-packed paintings of Parisian streets and nightclubs by Motley, done on a stay there in 1929, really jumps. A spacious enclosed hanging of seven monumental history paintings by Aaron Douglas generates a mood different from everything else, with its chapel-like quiet. And the source of some of the Douglas work is of interest in itself. Three of the paintings are on loan from the still little study collections of historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, namely Fisk University in Nashville, where Douglas taught for almost three decades, and Howard University in Washington, D.C. A major traveling exhibition, African Modernism in America, drawn from these collections and other HBCU collections, is at the Taft Museum of Art in Cincinnati through May 19th. But it's in three displays at the end of the show that specific political themes of the new Negro era are finally touched on. One section addresses the pervasiveness of colorism, social exclusion based on skin tone within the black community. Waring's 1920s painting, Mother and Daughter, of two women, one light-skinned, one darker, seen in overlapping profiles, coolly alludes to this. Sexual politics could also be a minefield. The Harlem Renaissance was surely as gay as it was black, Henry Louis Gates Jr. once wrote. Locke was gay, as were the sculptor Richmond Barth and the painter Richard Nugent. An installation with a sampling of their work, along with Buford Delaney's rainbow-hued nude portrait of the teenage James Baldwin, confirms this reality, though you have to go to the catalog to learn about the homophobia shared even by progressive black thinkers of the time, including Du Bois, one of the shortcomings of the show. A concluding small display, Artists as Activists, asserts the risk inherent simply by being black in America, risk that no effort at social uplift, even the current one, can mitigate. The illustrative material, at a glance, looks unsurprising. A photo of Marcus Garvey by Van Der Zee, a drawing of the Scottsboro Boys by Douglas, a print of a picket line by Roy DiCarava. But in a case in the center is a small sculpture of a female figure who seems to be rising from the flames. Created in 1919 by Meta Warwick Fuller and titled In Memory of Mary Turner as a Silent Protest Against Mob Violence, it was made in response to the death of a young pregnant black woman who was lynched and torched in Georgia the previous year. And once you know the story, Fuller's figure radiates like an emergency flare that won't go out. Like several other pocket-sized displays, this one could serve as a rough draft for bigger, deeper shows to come. And it underscores, as everything in Morrell's mind-prodding survey does, the functional value of what is now often referred to, with increasing disdain in the mainstream art world, as an art of identity politics, that is, an art that asserts, actively or incidentally, some measure of anti-assimilationist cultural solidarity. What Locke wanted for a new black art was the same visibility that white art has always had in the public consciousness, in the market, in the history books. But he also insisted that, in this new art, a black identity be foregrounded, maintained, and nurtured to create a fresh and distinctive cosmopolitanism. That's a dynamic evident in the Met show. And it was also the bottom line goal of the radical and now undervalued multiculturalist thinking of the late 20th century, which was a renaissance of its own and feels ripe for reassessment. That was the article, This Time, The Met Gets Harlem Right. It was written by Holland Carter and published February 20th, 2024 in the New York Times newspaper. My next story on today's African American Hour is titled, A Conversation with the History Curator of the California African American Museum. It was written by Sumaya Karlamangla and published February 7, 2024 in the New York Times NYTimes.com website. The subtitle to the story is, Susan D. Anderson talks about the forgotten history of California's earliest black residents. Black residents make up a relatively small share of California's population, but the state is so big that it's still a significant number of people. Roughly 1 in 20 black Americans lives in the state, according to the Public Policy Institute of California. Since February is Black History Month, I reached out to Susan D. Anderson, the history curator at the California African American Museum in Los Angeles, to learn a bit more about black history in the state, which stretches back to colonial times. What I find is that every phase of black history in California is misunderstood or not well represented, Anderson told me. It doesn't matter if it's the 18th century or the 20th century. Black history in California just doesn't get its due. Here's our conversation, lightly edited. People assume that because California was a free state, there were no enslaved people and slaveholders didn't bring enslaved people into the state. So there's just assumptions that are wrong. But the other piece of it is that academic historians still haven't really shifted their attention to the West as deeply or as broadly as they have paid attention to things like the 13 colonies or the South. If the West is an underdog in our historical understanding, then certainly black history in the West and in California has been overlooked for a long time. On this perception that there weren't enslaved people here, what was the reality? Even though California came into the United States with a constitution that said slavery wouldn't be tolerated, there were a lot of slaveholders who still saw this as a territory where they could expand slavery. They didn't give up the idea, even once California was in the Union. And there were plenty of those who brought enslaved people with them. California's first legislature was made up mostly of people who were enslavers and who were in favor of the enslavement of African Americans. William Gwin, the first U.S. Senator from California, had been a Mississippi plantation owner and a slaveholder. So they comprised the majority of the people who ran the government, the legislature, the courts, the schools, and they created laws that especially disenfranchised African Americans and indigenous people. Where are some of the earliest black settlements in California? Actually, black settlements were fairly rare. In the early history of the state, people lived anywhere they wanted. It was a largely unsettled place. Of course, cities like San Francisco and Sacramento were being built, but a vast majority of the people lived in gold country, and they lived in wilderness. In places like Marysville, there was a huge gold mining center. It was very evident that African Americans lived among the mostly white and Asian residents. There is also a perception that black people started coming to California as recently freed people or seeking work after World War II. They started coming to California before California was part of the United States. The first U.S. settler in San Diego was a black man. Alan Light and Richard Freeman ran businesses, and their adobe is actually preserved in Old Town. That's not even to mention the black people who came with the Spaniards. And the gold rush, when hundreds of thousands of people came to California for gold, black people were also part of that migration in 1849. There was never a time in California when there was no black presence once people who were not indigenous started settling the state. There was always a black presence. That was the article titled, A Conversation with the History Curator of the California African American Museum. It was written by Sumaya Carlamangla and published February 7th, 2024 in the nytimes.com website. My next reading is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Black History Month series that focuses on the role of African Americans and the arts. The title of this story is WCLK, Still Keeping Sound of Jazz Alive After 50 Years. It was published February 20th, 2024 and written by Leon Stafford. The subtitle to the story is, It went live in April 1974 and is now one of the nation's premier jazz stations. On April 10, 1974, Herbie Hancock's maiden voyage floated through the Atlanta airwaves on a new radio station with only 54 watts in a range that might, mind you, stretch 25 miles on a clear day. WCLK, operated by what was then Clark College as a public radio station, went on the air with the mission, bring to Atlanta a full-time station featuring the great masters of American music, Max Roach, Ella Fitzgerald, Nina Simone, and Thelonious Monk. After all, the leaders of the historically black college thought the city had a newly elected black mayor in Maynard Jackson, and if Atlanta wanted to be seen as world-class, it needed jazz. Then the music stopped. The first time we went on the air with Maiden Voyage, a few seconds we were off the air because something broke, laughed Quovatus G. Bro, the fledgling station's original program director. The engineer had to go find out where the glitch was and fix it. 50 years later, WCLK hasn't only fixed that initial glitch, but survived to become one of the nation's premier jazz stations, reaching about 100,000 listeners. It's a fixture in Atlanta's jazz scene, from partnering with the High Museum of Art on its Friday Jazz series, to being a longtime media partner of the Atlanta Jazz Festival. If you're a jazz artist, the station is a must-visit when you're in town and has hosted such luminaries as Gregory Porter, Natalie Cole, Diane Reeves, and Hancock. "Whenever Incognito came to Atlanta, we went straight there," said singer Misa, a former vocalist of the British Jazz Band. The next section of the story is titled, Putting Jazz Front and Center. In 2022, WCLK, now operated by Clark Atlanta University after the two schools merged in 1988, upped its significance to the jazz world by launching North America's first ever Jazz Music Awards. The ceremony, which officials hope will someday become an annual event, will focus on jazz artists, not as afterthoughts as they are during the Grammys or the American Music Awards, but as headliners of the show, said Ray Cornelius Cobb, WCLK's marketing and communications director. The inaugural Jazz Music Awards was held October 22, 2022 at the Cobb Energy Center with jazz legend Dee Dee Bridgewater and actor Delroy Lindo as hosts. When COVID hit, we lost a lot of jazz musicians, Cornelius said, in describing one of the reasons WCLK launched the awards. We were like, wow, okay, a lot of these people are dying off and no one is recognizing them. While jazz is its main focus, the station covers other genres, including gospel, Caribbean, and fusion. It can do so because, as a public radio station, it doesn't have to worry about ratings like commercial stations, allowing for more programming flexibility, said Rodney Evans, host of the station's gospel programming. We played everybody, all the hottest music, Evans said. Other stations would listen to us and then build their playlists off what we're doing. The next section is titled, Tight Budget. The station has an annual budget of around $2 million, said station manager Wendy Williams. About 20-30% of funding comes from Corporation for Public Broadcasting grants, while another 30% hails from the university. The station raises about $400,000 yearly through membership drives, while advertising and sales bring in close to another $400,000. It's been growing, she said, adding she hopes membership funding will soon hit $500,000 annually. There's been success. It's hard getting here, but we're getting there. Part of the challenge is the fragmentation of the market and the ever-growing list of ways consumers get music, news, and information, Williams said. The biggest threats it faces are streamers such as Apple Music and Spotify, and music on social media sites such as TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. A key to the station's growth is making sure it remains relevant. That means having a strong news presence as well as hosting programs on important issues such as health, financial literacy, and art, Williams said. It also means making sure you showcase young talent that can bridge the gap between older listeners and Gen Z. Artists such as bassist Esperanza Spalding, Jasmila Horn, and 24-year-old Samara Joy, who won Best New Artist in the 2023 Grammys, are helping to expose younger listeners to the segment. I always like to say, once you get hip, you get hooked, said Deb Moore, host of WCLK's Jazz at Sundown. Jamal Ahmad, host of WCLK's Soul of Jazz, said the station's history is really the story of Atlanta over the past 50 years. The station grew alongside the city from a sleepy southern town to a mecca for black Americans with all the highs and lows along the way. When you look at CLK in the 70s, it was just setting its feet planted in the ground, Ahmad said. WCLK alum Stan Washington said he is proud of what WCLK, or, as he used to call the 54-watt giant, has achieved. He said the vagaries of radio mean that nothing is certain, so it's a tribute to the hard work of the station's management and on-air talent that it is celebrating 50 years. I'm not surprised that it's lasted because it's still serving its purpose, he said. That was the article titled, WCLK Still Keeping Sound of Jazz Alive After 50 Years. It was published February 20th, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper and was written by Leon Stafford. My next story is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Its title is Photo Griot Sue Ross Tells Black Atlanta Story. It was published February 28, 2024, and written by Natrice Miller. If you have ever been to many black art exhibit, jazz concert, or community event in Atlanta, there's a chance you walk by a short woman with curly gray hair snapping photos. Her name is Susan Ross, and for the past 5 decades, she has told the story of black Atlanta through her thousands of images of politicians, artists, literary giants, community leaders, musicians, and just plain people. Most people know her simply as Sue. She isn't a member of the media, and although she worked for the city of Atlanta for almost 40 years, mostly in minority and female business development, photographer was never one of her official titles. She calls herself the multi-hyphenated participant observer, documentary photographer, cultural activist, just working in the city she refers to as Magical Atlanta. Before my big move from Charlotte, North Carolina to Atlanta in 2014, I searched online for black photographers in the city. Although I had a couple of contacts, I was ultimately starting fresh and wanted to make more connections. I came across the website of Susan J. Ross, the Photo Griot. I was mesmerized by her extensive archive and decided to send her an email. She never returned the email, but I guess the photo gods had better plans for me. A few months later, I saw her at a photo exhibition and introduced myself. "Hi, my name is Natrice. I'm a photographer and I just moved here. I saw your work online and wanted to introduce myself." "Hey," she responded with a friendly smile. I don't remember what she said about the email, but I do remember her saying, "You should come to a sistography meeting." I already knew sistography was a collective of black women photographers founded in 1993 by Sue and the late Sheila Turner, her friend and fellow photographer. I happily accepted her invitation and arrived at the campus of Spelman College the next Sunday for the next meeting. She moved to Atlanta from Connecticut as a young girl in the 1960s during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. Both of her parents, Hubert Ross, an anthropologist, and Edith Ross, a professor of social work, worked at Atlanta University. Growing up in Atlanta, she lived, worked, and played alongside the children of civil rights icons. Just kids in the neighborhood. Yoki is Yolanda King, and she was the oldest of the 4 King children, Sue told me. Her younger brother, Martin, who we called Marty growing up, and my brother were roughly the same age. She explained that back then, they weren't celebrities to her. They were regular family people, Sue told me. That's why I encourage young people today to take pictures of the folks that they're involved with, because you never know who's going to grow up to be the next leader in Atlanta or in the world, or who has a story to tell about our people. The beauty of Sue's work is that she doesn't just observe and take pictures. She is an active member of the very community that she photographs. She didn't just take photos of Maynard Jackson, Atlanta's first black mayor. She helped to get him elected. "We went out and organized, got on flatbed trucks and went into the housing project," said Sue, who attended Pomona College, Atlanta University, and Stanford University. "We did a lot of energetic work for Maynard." Her work documenting the 1996 Olympic Games, or Portraits of Nelson Mandela and Barack Obama, resides in dozens of books like Reflections in Black, A History of African American Photographers. And her acclaimed 2011 solo exhibition, Sankofa, Looking Back to Move Forward, explored the then 22-year history of the National Black Arts Festival. Her portraits of Miles Davis are in the permanent collection of Clark Atlanta University Art Galleries, and her work can also be found in the collections of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Georgia, Spelman College, and in private collections. "But the thing I admire most is her connection to the Atlanta community. The most important people in her images may not be known to the people outside of the state, but through their contributions to Atlanta, they have been a part of change. Women like Sue remind me of the importance of the work I do and the power of an image. I have been interested in black history since I was a little girl. My mother constantly bought me books that educated and celebrated black people. My love for the culture has grown exponentially since then. The fact that I get to tell the multifaceted stories of black people in my personal work and on many of my assignments for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is something that I don't take for granted. She also reminds me of the importance of representation. When I walk down the street holding camera gear, I see little black children staring in amazement. They don't know me or the quality of my work, and honestly, I don't think that they care. They just feel proud that someone who looks like them is out in the world doing the work to reshape and reclaim narratives. That was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution article titled, Photo Griot, Sue Ross Tells Black Atlanta Story. It was published Wednesday, February 28, 2024, and written by Natrice Miller. Next on the African American Hour, I have two stories from the Dayton, Ohio Daily News newspaper. They focus on the 2024 Black History Month theme of African Americans and the Arts. The first story is titled, Musicians Did Not Engage in Black Music Traditions, They Broke Them. It was written by Ricky Vincent. Since the late 1970s, Dayton has been known as the land of funk to many, especially the crowds at the clubs, thanks in part to the band Lakeside and their 1980 smash hit Fantastic Voyage. It was the role of the great bands of the day to take you away, to get away, as Earth, Wind, and Fire put it, to some kind of funky town that for the dancers and fans was far from where they had been earning a paycheck the last 40 hours of the week. Yet the process to get to the land of funk was still fraught with ambiguities. What is this land of funk? Where is it? Can one get there on a plane, in a car, a spaceship? Or possibly through the existential experience of the funk, through the dance? African American music has always been about taking someone there. Wherever it is somewhere other than Jim Crow America. Somewhere beyond the confines of the oppressive spaces in the USA, where blackness is somehow a curse rather than a treasure. So the great recording artists of the 20th century, from Duke Ellington to Charlie Parker to Nina Simone to Aretha Franklin to James Brown, all sought to create a world where one can inhabit the space and not feel the sting of oppression, to relish in that moment and feel one's freedom. A great many artists from Ohio began celebrating that freedom as soon as they crossed the Mason-Dixon line on that mid-century Great Migration North. It's well known that Dayton's black community was stable and sturdy and provided many young players of the era with opportunities to learn music, to purchase instruments, to practice and to develop into bands. With the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base providing employment as the home of Project Blue Book investigating UFOs in the 1960s, one might say extraterrestrial inspiration to the black community, Dayton musicians were not engaged in black music traditions so much as breaking them. In 1972, Walter Junie Morrison of the Ohio Players tinkered with the sounds of his new ARP-1000 synthesizer and contrived the Funky Worm that could play guitar without any hands, which developed into a number one R&B hit and became a staple of hip-hop samples for decades. Ohio Players guitarist Leroy Sugarfoot Bonner was a bona fide blues giant, but in the Players he pushed the sound beyond traditional boundaries. The swinging feel of Jive Turkey, Part 1, had a familiar down-home blues pace. But the extended version was another matter. The wildly original inverted funk arrangement of Jive Turkey, Part 2, took the blues down a roller coaster of a winding road that let fans of the multi-platinum band know both where their roots were and where the future was going. When Roger Troutman of Zapp mastered the talk box, actually a vocoder, he pushed the boundaries of the dance floor party sound. Everyone was trying to sound futuristic, and Roger's talk box involved placing a tube in his mouth in which he would talk and sing into his keyboard and produce electrified human vocal sounds. The impact was exhilarating, creating hit after hit, and reached the hip-hop world through his collaboration with Dr. Dre and Tupac in California Love in 1995. Zapp and Roger would become one of the most sampled acts in hip-hop history. Rogers' first national exposure came in 1976 on Wanna Make Love, Come Flick My Bick, by the Dayton band Sun, led by Byron Bird, a band that indulged in interplanetary themes over seven albums for Capitol Records from 1976 to 1982. It's the black experience. It's the blues of the 80s. It has the same purpose with black people as blues had for black people when B.B. King started out, or Jimmy Reed, Roger explained to me in 1995. These Dayton artists were determined to take the essence of the blues, the raw feel, and modernize it for the electronic generation, thinking far above and beyond while still delivering more bounce to the ounce. That was the article titled, Musicians Did Not Engage in Black Music Traditions, They Broke Them. It appeared in the Dayton Daily News on February 4th, 2024, and was written by Ricky Vincent, who was a guest columnist, and he is also the author of Funk, The Music, the People, and the Rhythm of the One. He is also Associate Professor of Critical Ethnic Studies at California College of the Arts. My next story from the February 4th, 2024 edition of the Dayton Daily News is titled, A Mindset Free from the Need to Wear the Mask. It was written by guest columnist Countess Winfrey. If I could illustrate my perspective of Afrofuturism, I'd say it's like remodeling a house that is centuries old. Inside of this house is old ideation, old customs, old mindsets, none of which have served the African American community, but have only created barriers we need to break through. Reimagining the design, adding fresh coats of paint, new drapes, new customs, new ideation, new mindsets. This is Afrofuturism. Afrofuturism is an imagination of what could be. It's creating a world where there's no fear of walking down the street, no boundaries, and no enslaved mentalities. Creating a world where there is joy, peace, love, and light. A boundless and limitless world that looks, sounds, smells, tastes, and feels like freedom. Afrofuturism is a concept becoming more and more prevalent in the black arts arena. Why? Because many black artists, including myself, recognize the necessity of preserving our history and culture through our art. Subsequently, much of what black art has focused on is the African American experience from a historical or present-day perspective. Recently, there have been an obscene number of efforts to erase black history from our educational systems, from national attacks on Nicole Hannah-Jones' 1619 project to the Ohio legislature's attempts to ban teaching about racism. It seems the only place to learn about and share our life and culture is through our art. As a performing artist with the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company, many of the works we perform are created in response to the African American experience. As a budding choreographer, I too have found myself following this trajectory. The beautiful yet challenging aspect of Afrofuturistic creation is that it is all imagined, never before seen, heard, or felt. It wasn't until I received a commission from the Cincinnati Art Museum for their Black Future series that I allowed myself to access the Afrofuturistic lens. In my site-specific work entitled Homage, What Was, Is, To Come, I began to imagine how I wanted to see black folks in the future. I thought about what that future space would look like, sound like, taste like, and smell like. And I thought about how I would want black people to feel. I began to see the concept of Afrofuturism as a mindset free from stereotypes or judgment or the need to wear the mask. To quote from Daytonian Paul Lawrence Dunbar, in creating this work, I challenged myself to be brave enough to create a world rather than solely shining light on the world we already live in. As a native Nashville Tennessean, moving to Dayton was my first taste of living up north. In the 10 years I've lived here, I've learned so much about the role that Ohio has played in African American history. In my most recent work, Somewhere They Freed Themselves, premiered by Mutual Dance Theater in December 2023, I was inspired by the Ohio River being a conduit for African Americans' trek from freedom by way of water. I look forward to expanding this work and focusing on creating the freedom space from an Afrofuturistic perspective. I am elated to see a number of black people dreaming of black futures in Dayton. Being able to witness several young black business owners reimagining, reclaiming, and reinvigorating these buildings in the greater Dayton area is an example of the Afrofuturistic mindset. Witnessing the resurgence of the Dayton region has been extremely motivating in my pursuit to continue to dream about incorporating a futuristic realm in my work. I look forward to many more opportunities to witness these black imaginations come to life. That was a column titled, A Mindset Free from the Need to Wear the Mask. It was written by guest columnist Countess Winfrey, who is a professional dancer, teaching artist, and choreographer. This article appeared in the Dayton, Ohio Daily News on February 4th, 2024. Next on today's African American Hour is an obituary from the Washington Post. The title is, David E. Harris, first black pilot for a major U.S. carrier, dies at 89. It was written by Brian Murphy and published March 12, 2024. David E. Harris, a former Air Force flyer who became the first black pilot for a major U.S. passenger airline in the 1960s, after battles by others to enter the industry, including a landmark anti-discrimination claim backed by the Supreme Court, died March 8th at a hospice center in Marietta, Georgia. He was 89. The death was announced by his family in American Airlines, where Mr. Harris worked from 1964 to 1994. No specific cause of death was noted. As Harris rose to captain at American, he became a symbol of black achievement during the Civil Rights Movement. Within the world of aviation, he was hailed as a trailblazer along with the Tuskegee Airmen of World War II and people such as Bessie Coleman, the first black woman known to earn a pilot's license. Mr. Harris always was quick to note that he found a place in the cockpit at American after years of struggles by other black pilots. "There is no way I should be first," he said. "It should have happened long before 1964. Another former black aviator from the Air Force, Marlon D. Green, who had been hired by Continental Airlines in 1957, but the offer was rescinded. After a six-year court battle, the Supreme Court in April 1963 upheld a decision in Green's favor by the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Commission. The High Court ruling also sent a wider message to the U.S. airline industry on hiring practices. Green began flying for Continental in January 1965. Earlier, other black pilots denied jobs at big U.S. carriers found different roles in the air, including ex-Tuskegee Airman Perry Young with a helicopter service in the New York area and August Martin flying a cargo aircraft. The reality is that there were 500 pilots, Tuskegee Airmen, who were qualified for airline jobs when they left the service, Mr. Harris said at an event in 2008. Timing and fate, however, handed Mr. Harris a place in aviation history. He almost dared airlines to take him, just months after President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, by intentionally pointing out his race in applications. "I'm married, I have two children, and I am black," he recalled that he wrote on his cover letters. He was turned down by several carriers, he said, before being hired by American on December 3, 1964, 2 days after he left the Air Force. The airline's purported reply to Mr. Harris's application became part of company lore. "We don't care if you're black, white, or chartreuse. We only want to know, can you fly a plane?" During 9 weeks of training, one of his roommates, unaware of Mr. Harris's race because of his light complexion, made frequent racist remarks, Mr. Harris recalled. He privately fumed but decided not to speak out. Mr. Harris said he wanted to avoid anything that could disrupt getting his civilian wings. "I was perfectly aware that there weren't any black pilots flying with the airlines," Mr. Harris told South Carolina Living in 2015. After the training, Mr. Harris became a co-pilot. He was promoted to captain in 1967. American Airlines featured Mr. Harris in an ad in Ebony magazine in the 1970s, and he was part of the first all-black cockpit crew in 1984. While a flight was boarding in 1967 in Indianapolis, Mr. Harris introduced himself to one of the passengers, National Urban League Executive Director Whitney Young Jr., and thanked him for his work in the civil rights movement. Young drowned in 1971 while swimming in the surf near Lagos, Nigeria, and his body was brought by an Air Force plane to New York. His widow asked that Mr. Harris pilot the Special American Airlines charter to bring Young's remains to his native Kentucky for burial. On board the flight was a contingent that included civil rights leaders Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson. Mr. Harris joked that his wife told him, "Don't screw this one up. You'll wipe out the whole civil rights movement." David Ellsworth Harris was born in Columbus, Ohio on December 22, 1934. His father was a self-employed tradesman and installed service station equipment. His mother was a homemaker. As a boy, he was not particularly fascinated by aviation, he said. "Maybe it was there, but out to the back of my mind," he recalled, "because there were no minority role models out there as airline pilots. World War II and the Tuskegee Airmen had come and gone." At Ohio State University, he joined Air Force ROTC while studying for a degree in education. He graduated in 1957 and joined the Air Force a year later as a lieutenant, serving on bases in the United States and England. His assignments included being part of the crews for B-47 and B-52 bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons. He left the Air Force with the rank of captain. For American, he flew various aircraft, including the Boeing 747 and Airbus 300. Captain Harris opened the doors and inspired countless black pilots to pursue their dreams to fly, according to a statement from American Airlines Chief Executive Robert Isom. By the late 1960s, many of the major U.S. carriers had at least one black pilot. Currently, about 3% of U.S. commercial pilots identify as black, according to the Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. During his years with American, Mr. Harris said, he did not encounter direct racial insults. He noticed, though, the stares he sometimes received while passing through airports in the South and elsewhere in his uniform. "No one was abusive, but you could tell from the body language," he told the Tulsa World in 2008, describing his feelings of unease. Mr. Harris's marriage to Lynn Purdy Harris ended in divorce. Survivors include 2 daughters, 6 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. That was the Washington Post obituary titled, "David E. Harris, First Black Pilot for Major U.S. Carrier Dies at 89. It was written by Brian Murphy and published March 12, 2024. I'm going to wrap up today's program with the story about books. The title is 5 New Books on Black History. It was written by Suzanne Van Atten and published February 6, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. From a deep dive on a giant of the civil rights movement to insights on the topic of reparations to celebrating women's contribution to social change in the military, here are 5 brand new books coming to you just in time for Black History Month. John Lewis, In Search of the Beloved Community. Touted as the first comprehensive biography of civil rights leader John Lewis, this 588-page biography by historian Raymond Arsenault takes a granular approach to the details of Lewis's life, beginning with his childhood pursuit of preaching to chickens to navigating changes in the Democratic Party when it chose Barack Obama over longtime ally Hillary Clinton for the 2008 presidential nominee. Along the way, it charts Lewis's work with the Freedom Fighters, the March on Washington, and Bloody Sunday, the protest march in Selma, Alabama, where he was brutally beaten by a state trooper, as well as his 3 decades as a congressman. The Stolen Wealth of Slavery, A Case for Reparations. Follow the Money has been the credo of investigative journalists since the days of Watergate, and that's just what journalist David Montero does in this book that reveals how Northern corporations accumulated tremendous wealth from slavery and financial institutions such as Citibank, Bank of America, and Bank New York helped bankroll it. Acknowledging the dozens of universities, religious organizations, and nonprofit endowments that have publicly admitted being complicit in slavery and made efforts towards reparations since the racial reckoning of 2020, Montero identifies some of the major corporations and banking institutions that have remained mostly silent. In a call to action, Montero writes, "The unraveling of lies in amnesia, oblivion, and deceit has yet to come, but it can no longer wait." Radical reparations. African-American studies scholar Marcus Anthony Hunter also addresses reparations in his new book, but he takes a different approach by focusing on the future of what reparations should look like. By weaving together deep wells of research with elements of memoir and creative nonfiction accounts of historical events, Hunter makes a case for expanding reparations beyond the economic. He asserts that the damage inflicted by the slave trade can't just be measured in money. In order to end racial inequity and heal racial trauma, there also must be a political, intellectual, legal, social, spatial, and spiritual reparations. Metker and Murley. Joanne Reed, host of MSNBC's The Readout, and New York Times bestselling author The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story, takes up an up-close look at the lives of civil rights activists Metker and Murley Evers. The college sweethearts were partners in the fight for racial equality, striving for black voting rights and to desegregate the University of Mississippi, until Metker was murdered by the Klan in 1963 outside their home in Jackson, Mississippi. In his absence, Murley carried on the fight, writing a book about her husband and becoming a leader in the NAACP. No Better Time. In this historical novel, Kentucky author Sheila Williams focuses on a handful of key women to tell the story of a battalion of black servicewomen sent overseas during World War II. The 6,888th Central Postal Directory Battalion were the only black WACs, short for Women's Army Corps, to serve overseas during the war. Assigned to a post in England, they were tasked with processing 17 million pieces of mail that were warehoused for 2 years. No Better Time explores the various reasons women wanted to go to war, the freedom and acceptance they experienced in Europe, and the racism they endured from white fellow service members. That was the article titled, Five New Books on Black History. It was written by Suzanne Van Atten and published February 6, 2024, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or archived at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.